All right, welcome back again. Sorry for all this disruption for Trumpet World. What we're going to try and do is get an update from Jeremiah first on the earthquakes in Nepal, and then that should hopefully give us a little time to get Andrew's microphone working and find out about the fires in Los Angeles. So, Jeremiah, you had this massive earthquake hitting this area that I think is known as the Northern Gateway to Mount Everest. When I last wrote up the story on Monday, I think it was about 100 dead. And how's the picture developed? Is that still a similar number?
Yes. Well, the death toll has climbed to 126 as of this morning, and almost 200 are injured as well. 46,000 people have been displaced by this earthquake. And this is it's a region that experiences quite a few earthquakes because it sits right on the edge of two different tectonic plates. But this one was a 7.1 as recorded by the U.S. Geological Survey. So that's just a massive earthquake, far beyond the, you know, somewhat regular ones that they would suffer there. And Tibet, of course, is at an extremely high altitude there in the Himalayas. So it's a place with many communities that are extremely difficult to access. It's also very, very cold there at present, well below freezing. So all of these factors made this earthquake even more devastating and very difficult to even assess the full impact of it at this point. Very difficult for rescue teams to get to those communities that have been, you know, most severely impacted by this as well. So just a really difficult situation there for the Tibetans.
And this is not a prosperous location, I'm as I understand it. Is this something that I guess is going to take them, it's going to hit hard quite a while to rebuild? I think I saw widespread structure damages. Is that the case as well?
Well, I would imagine so, largely because of how difficult to access many of these communities are in the Himalayas there. Tibet, of course, is one of these regions that would like to be independent. They would like to be their own nation, as they were for quite a long time before China colonized them. But I suppose there's a little bit of a potential silver lining there, since they are part of China now. Then you have, you know, the Chinese state will be working to help rebuild and working to fund the reconstruction of the communities that have been impacted.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. We'll come back to you to talk about your Asia story in a little bit. We'll have another go and see if we can get Andrew for an update on some of these Los Angeles fires. Otherwise, I'll do the best I can giving you some of what's going on there. So, Andrew, are you able to? We'll see if you can join us now.
All right. Well, hopefully that's working.
Yes, there we go. That's got it.
Yeah, this crisis in Los Angeles is really hard to underestimate. It could end up being the most expensive natural disaster in U.S. history. There's already been at least 10 people killed and multiple tens of thousands, something like 80,000 people displaced. You mentioned in your opening about even like Hollywood celebrities having their houses burnt down. There's actually been 10,000 structures burnt down, which is going to cost at least $150 billion. It could create actually a pretty severe insurance crisis, and in that, like, even though the insurance companies in California do expect wildfires, they don't normally expect them this bad. So, I mean, in order to be able to shell out all the coverages for the structures that insurance companies have covered and have been incinerated is going to be insanely expensive. There's a shortage of firefighters in California, so they're struggling even more than they usually do to get this under control. And really, this whole crisis, I think it's the result of this crisis is equal parts divine cursing and just human stupidity. The divine cursing is that there's been a severe drought in California for decades. Now, this year is not actually that bad. They've gotten relatively normal rainfall this year, but it's not so much about the rain, it's about the ice packs in the mountains, which is where the rivers come from, where most of the water comes from. So they're actually still fighting, like, you need water to put out the fire. And they're still fighting water shortages because the ice packs have been so depleted from so much drought, in addition to the fact that it's just generally dry and conducive for fires. Now, the human stupidity angle is something Donald Trump's been calling out California for a long time. As he said, that used to be in California, the Forest Service spent quite a bit of time and effort clearing out the underbrush so that if a fire caught, it just didn't rip through tens of thousands of acres. More recently, due to mainly like environmental concerns, like there's animals that live in the underbrush, and they've the environmental movements convinced the fire department to stop clearing out that underbrush, which has made fires in California worse. If you graph it, you can see that like back before California was settled, there's evidence that there were routinely huge fires like this, and then they kind of died down as people started like grooming and maintaining the forest there. Now that they've stopped doing that, you combine all the underbrush that the Forest Service has let grow with the droughts that humans have no control over, and you get a very dry tinderbox-like condition where fire just burns through it, and you're struggling to find enough water to put it out because the ice packs in the mountains are very depleted from having like 20 years of extreme drought.
Right. So it's a combination of those issues. And we saw, I think a lot of the news this morning is focused on this guy that's been arrested with a blowtorch or something like that, that's accused of fighting these fires. So yeah, like there's a human, there's potentially deliberate arsonists, there is the human neglect, but then there is, well, why do we have these general conditions that let this happen? And I wanted to play a clip from a Key of David program that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry gave about 3 years ago that talked about this general issue of, well, why do we have these weather curses? I mean, why do we have these natural disasters? This gets to both of what we've just talked about with California and also Nepal. Why does a loving God allow these to happen? So we could play the first clip from that Key of David.
Greetings, everyone. The British and American peoples, especially the British peoples around the world, along with the American nation, have a variety of views about climate change. And I don't want to talk to you about political views today, except one, and it is a deadly, deceptive view that is going to affect every single one of us if we believe it. There was an ex-U.S. Secretary of State that recently talked about this subject on television. And he said that all of these violent storms that you see around America and the world are caused by climate change. Now, that is just about the most deadliest deception you could possibly hear, and I want to show you why. There are many others that have that view. They have it, they believe it, but today I want to bring God's view into this climate change controversy. This is about, well, let's say what it's not about. It's not about a political view. It's about a biblical view that certainly is going to affect every one of you dramatically and profoundly. It is surely one of the gravest subjects that we need to get into and talk about, and it's that most deadly climate change deception. I want to talk to you about that today.
I mean, that's an important point to note, because every time that you get this, you get fires. I mean, earthquakes a bit less. I do think I've seen some of the more loony fringes saying earthquakes are caused by climate change. That I don't think is a mainstream position.
I've even seen tsunamis and volcanoes being attributed to climate change as well.
Huh. I guess tsunamis... No, I can't really see either of those. I mean, that's more of an extreme position. But certainly every time you get these wildfires, people talk about this being climate change. And... You know, Mr. Flurry in there brings out that Bible perspective. And that is that there are a lot of biblical verses that talk about God controlling the weather. And you know, these weather conditions, dry, getting enough water from the mountains, this kind of thing, snow, this is all something that God claims to control. And if we believe the Bible, well, that's what the Bible is telling us. This is another clip from that Key of David program.
Notice Nahum 1 in verse 3. This is an end time prophetic book. And here's what the statement is there that I want to focus on. The Eternal is slow to anger and great in power and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Eternal has His way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of His feet. Here now is the ex-Secretary of State saying that these storms are all caused by climate change, and that's the very antithesis of what God says. When He's talking about the storms, He wants you to know that He has a great, great, profound power in the storms and the hurricanes and all of that. And He goes on to say in this book and in this verse that those storms and those violent hurricanes and the like are actually directly related to our way of life, the way we live.
And that's an important point from your Bible, that these storms, these hurricanes, these events, they're all related to the way we live. This is God getting our attention. And I saw a clip that kind of did the rounds on Twitter where someone dropped a bit of a truth bomb on Fox News, telling them that live, and they did not at all like that message. But this is, I think, is especially significant when you see this hitting California. And we had an article, Mr. Flurry wrote it in 2003. We updated it in 2018. Maybe we need to update it again, called "Is California Under a Curse?" And in that article, Mr. Flurry talks quite a bit about Herbert W. Armstrong, an individual that plays a very important role, that through whom God revealed a whole load of these very foundational prophecies. And the Key of David program this weekend is on Mr. Armstrong. It's just gone up today. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but you can get that on our YouTube channel, on our homepage. And I'd really encourage you to go and watch that. That's, I'm sure, a great introduction to Mr. Armstrong. And in this article, he talks about all of these weather curses that are hitting California. He says, is there a connection to what is happening in California and God's work through Herbert W. Armstrong? The whole world must come to see that there is. California was saturated with God's warning message more than any other state. Mr. Armstrong also warned the whole world. So there's accountability for hearing that warning message. And that state even persecuted Mr. Armstrong through legal methods. Now, when you see something like that is happening in Tibet, well, you know, God also says in the Bible that some of these disasters, they're not specifically targeted, but if we're not obeying God, we don't receive His protection. And all of the world is vulnerable to those kind of disasters. And so that article is California Under a Curse, talks more specifically about California. We have our free book as well, Why Natural Disasters, with natural in quotes, that also talks about these and why a loving God uses these and how He uses these to get our correction, get our attention, to correct us, to get us to turn away from these self-destructive behaviors that are tearing our nations apart. So that gives you the bigger picture on these, and you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com, as well. Well, Andrew, did you have any more you wanted to add on that weather story before we get on to your other kind of main story for today?
Well, I definitely think the climate change distraction is a really powerful point for people to understand. And there's a lot of fraud in the climate change debate. Almost every time you see a graph of the number of acres burned by wildfire per year, it starts the year they stopped clearing the brush out. And so it looks like there's this dramatic uptick in wildfires, which there has been. But it doesn't actually look back at some of the big wildfires I've had in the past. But the interesting thing about, you know, God's blessing on America and then this curse on California, due to how that state treated Mr. Armstrong and all that, is when it comes to drought, is a drought's a specific type of natural disaster, which is one of the easiest types for humans to be able to look back at the record of drought in a region. Because trees grow faster when there's rain and they grow slower when there's drought. So if you measure the width of a tree ring, you can get a rough estimate of what the rainfall that year was. And you go out through the western United States, California included, and you'll find that this region was experiencing devastating mega droughts for centuries when there were no, back before European colonists came here. No, the Native Americans weren't driving cars or burning coal or doing anything to generate carbon, but you still had these devastating mega droughts. Those stopped right about in the year 1600 when the first people of Israelite descent came through here. And while there'd been an occasional drought here or there, nothing nearly as bad as what there used to be before the end-time descendants of Israel showed up in the United States. It's only been about since Mr. Armstrong died, the past 20, 30 years, that California's drought has actually gotten so bad that you'll see headlines saying that, like, okay, this is the worst drought since the year 800 when Charlemagne was crowned and the Mayan Empire was still active. So you're not seeing, like, this apocalyptic, catastrophic, unprecedented mega droughts due to the Californians driving too many SUVs. Is what you're actually seeing is a return to the way the weather was in North America before the first Israelite colonist showed up here and God took this 400-year period to really just bless the weather. And I think when you overlook that fraud and actually take the long view, you actually should just be asking the questions like, well, why is the weather unseasonably... There was been like rain in due season from the time the colonists showed up into Jamestown until about the time Mr. Armstrong died. Before that, there wasn't, and now there isn't. So that can really start getting you to ask some questions. Like, okay, well, what is it that made God change his mind to actually start cursing the weather the way the weather was before he started blessing the Americans and Canadians when they came over?
Yeah, that's also a valuable perspective that you see not just God's ability to curse the weather inside this, but God's ability to bless as well. And in that case, you know, God promised blessings due to Abraham's obedience to his descendants. Those blessings were poured out, and we didn't use them. Now as we did not obey God, those curses are setting in. And that's something Herbert W. Armstrong explains in more detail in The United States and Britain in Prophecy that we've got up on the screen now. But up on our website, I think now or very shortly, we've got your latest article, Andrew, on all of the events that have happened in North America this week. Probably by the time we finish the show, it will be up there. I mean, it's been a big week for the North American continent. We've had Don Jr. visiting Greenland. We've had Justin Trudeau that has now resigned from leadership of Canada, from prime ministership. I was working very hard not to say president. So that article is Trump's vision for North America. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, the other big story that people haven't paid nearly as much attention to this year as they did 4 years ago was the January 6th certification of the presidential election. That went much more smoothly than it did in January 6th, 2021. But now, after, like, the day after he's certified, Trump's like, okay, he's like, I'm certified, I'm due to be sworn in, no backsies now. He gave this press conference, where he just honestly laid out his view for North America. And to me, at least, it almost sounded like something that Theodore Roosevelt would have given in that It's a pretty amazing press conference, and just how big he's thinking in terms of making America a global superpower. He obviously reiterated his promise to secure the U.S. southern border and to increase offshore oil drilling. He promised to, or said we should, change the Gulf of Mexico, the name of the Gulf of Mexico, to the Gulf of America. Just showing some just general patriotism here is that, like, well, more of that Gulf has a coastline with the United States than it has with Mexico. So we should really name that Gulf and start taking more control over global trade routes. He reiterated something he said in a Truth Social post a few weeks ago about how the United States needs to get the Panama Canal back. He said that we should have never given it back. We're very reliant on it for trade. When we did give it back, we gave it back to Panama, not China, and we gave it back to Panama on the condition that they use it neutrally. So the fact that they're inviting all these Chinese companies in here means that they've broken the agreement, and he thinks they have a right to go in there and bring that canal back. And he wouldn't say whether he's planning on doing this economically or militarily. It could go either way. But even Congress now is looking at passing legislation that would give Trump the right to take the actions he needs to look at getting that really important waterway back in United States hands. As you mentioned, while President Trump was giving this press conference, his son, Donald Trump Jr., was in Greenland, and Trump also reiterated that since Greenland's also an important naval choke point, not as important as the Panama Canal, but could become as important as the Panama Canal if some of the ice near the Northwest Passage starts opening up, that melts and opens up that sea lane. And so he said it was an absolute necessity to acquire Greenland, and that he'd be willing to put a very high tariff on Denmark if they did anything to stop him from acquiring that island. Because right now, the Greenlanders have wanted independence for years. They've definitely wanted independence from Denmark. The only reason they haven't done it is like 25% of their gross domestic product is subsidies from Denmark. So there'd be a huge standard of living decrease. They need a new patron or new investment in their economy to be able to be independent and self-sufficient. But he's really looking at supporting Greenland's bid for independence in the short term, and at least increasing U.S. investment in the area and look into possibly getting that as a territory, as a state in the future. And then his third pillar behind getting the Panama Canal and acquiring Greenland for the United States is this is the first time I've heard him talking about making Canada the 51st state, where I've actually been convinced that he's like in earnest or serious. He's been teasing Justin Trudeau for a long time about it, and I think I've said on this program before that I felt like he was just trolling Justin Trudeau in order to get him to resign. Well, now he has resigned. It worked. The trolling work. He's resigned as Prime Minister of Canada, and Trump's still saying that he's looking at putting a tariff on Canada because he's like, we spend a lot of money defending Canada, and and they get really good trade deals with Canada. He's like, we're almost treating them like citizens, but they're not citizens yet. So he's like, he said, if they want to join the United States, they're very welcome. If they don't want to join the United States, we are going to have to look at some trade terms for them that aren't as favorable as they've gotten in the past. And so we really don't know which direction that story is going to go, but taken as a whole with the Panama and the Greenland and the Canada, you can see that Donald Trump's definitely looking at like a fortress North America, like where the United States is the dominant power in North America. Securing the border with Mexico, securing the trade through the Panama Canal, securing our naval outputs and rare earth mineral mines in Greenland, and making sure that Canada, if they don't outright join the United States, is definitely a power that secures its own borders, and so the other nations can't traffic fentanyl and illegal immigrants or other things into the United States using Canada as a proxy.
And I think in some ways this does tie into what we were talking about with the fires and with blessings and curses, because last week's Key of David program was from Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry talking about exactly this, talking about the Panama Canal. And he made a really, what I thought was a really powerful point at the end, where he was talking about, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, the driving force behind getting that canal built, and how his book, I think it was called Fear God and Take Your Own Part. So he was somebody that feared God to a certain extent. And ultimately these blessings, like these ocean-going choke points, were specifically promised in the Bible. Particularly the Panama Canal, as a blessing to Abraham, a man who very greatly feared God. And Mr. Flurry said, well, whether Donald Trump's reforms, whether this plan for North America ultimately becomes a success or not, it's going to come down to that, whether we fear God. We can play that clip.
This is about all of us that God is talking about, that if we want to be great, we'll only be great through God and fearing Him. That's what it's all about. The gate emphasized. Perhaps it indicates that this history, there may be more history here in this gate. Maybe President-elect or President Donald Trump, when he gets in office and is inaugurated, he has the power to do a lot of things, and there will be more miracles that come if we learn a lesson in that process. God wants to teach us how to fear God and not have to be punished for our sins. And that is a sin when you turn away from a gift like that that God has given us. This is not a partisan view of things.
And this is, there is an opportunity here, and God is willing to, you know, he's the weather curses, they get our attention, but if there's repentance, well, there can be blessings, and it's only by fearing God that these can be permanent. I'll also just mention, while we're talking about North America and your point about Canada, we did do a whole show on Canada back on Wednesday with Canadian correspondent, Mr. Abraham Blondeau. He gave his thoughts on Canada becoming the 51st state. And I'd also say, watch this space on Canada. I think we've got some pretty exciting coverage lined up. Perhaps the most high profile guest that we've ever had so far on Trumpet World, if all goes well. We will be talking to him next week and airing that for you in just a little bit. So we will have plenty of coverage on them as they go into this election. And I think there are worldwide lessons to learn from what has just gone horribly wrong in Canada. Well, Andrew, did you have anything more you wanted to add? Otherwise, I might just bring in Jeremiah a little early, because his subject also kind of touches on Fortress Americas. But before we do that, was there any other material you wanted to get in here?
Oh, well, I probably won't have too much more. But yeah, it's definitely exciting times to watch. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, has likened Donald Trump to an end-time type of King Jeroboam II, who wasn't necessarily the most righteous king, but God still showed a lot of mercy and blessed Israel during his reign so that they would have at least an opportunity to repent. But it is interesting that when you look at the history of Jeroboam II, he did also preside over a period of some fairly significant territorial expansion in ancient Israel, and I don't know how much of that ancient history is applicable to the modern day type, but we definitely know from this press conference Trump gave that he's thinking bigger than any president since James K. Polk, probably, in terms of like territorial expansion, actually looking at gaining new strategic sea gates that would make America a great power if its people are humble enough to turn to God and allow Him to bless them in that way. But in other news, well, we already talked about the Yeah, I guess the only other two stories I brought with me today is the some bad news on the Biden administration's decision to release 11 Yemeni prisoners that had been held in Guantanamo Bay. They were allegedly the bodyguards for the 9/11 mastermind, Osama bin Laden, and have obviously been in prison for something like 20 years now. And then Biden, I guess in terms of his outreach to radical Islam, decides to release these people out and back into society. And then also Elon Musk is continuing his new tradition that many people are getting irritated with him before of recommending who should be the leaders of various countries. Last week he was talking about how the alternative for Deutschland is the only party in Germany that's going to secure its border and protect German people from Islamic extremism. Today, he's really criticizing, or this week, criticizing British Prime Minister Keith Starmer for his failure to protect citizens from the Pakistani grooming gangs. He was trying to push King Charles III to dissolve Parliament and call re-elections for a while. I don't think Charles III is going to do that, but Elon Musk definitely isn't going to let up on the pressure on Prime Minister Starmer anytime soon.
And I think that does tie into another interesting story from the U.S. this week with Keir Starmer, actually. He's the more unusual, but very... I think who was it? There was some other socialist leader, politician in Britain called Keir. I think he's named after him. But you are building up to potentially a big clash about regulating social media, because it was also this week that Meta came out and said we're going to stop censorship on Meta, which is interesting because Meta have never really said we're censoring on Meta, but they said we're going to get rid of all of our fact checkers. And we're going to switch to this community note style system starting in the United States. What is kind of interesting about that is illegal in Europe. Like, by law, big groups like Meta, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, that's all under their umbrella. You've got to have fact checkers. You've got to have censorship. The British government, they're very incensed by Elon Musk. Their response is to ban stuff they don't like. So they're looking at more, you know, can we block Twitter, punish Elon Musk, fine him. It was last summer they were talking about arresting Elon Musk, which, good luck with that. I mean, yeah, America, like, they're Britain and America do have an extradition treaty, but you cannot extradite someone from the United States for something that is not a crime in the United States, and he would be protected by the First Amendment. But you've got, I think, shifting towards more regulation in Europe, less regulation and free speech in the United States with that ruling from Meta. That is building to a clash. I think even the Greenland story is kind of there's a lot that I think is exposing Europe's impotence right now. The fact that Meta just ignored EU law and said we're going to end this kind of censorship, that was pretty humiliating. But even Greenland, where Donald Trump is saying, well, we're going to get Greenland, and various different EU leaders are up in arms about this and have been criticizing it. But there isn't really a whole lot they can do. Greenland got the right to hold a referendum in 2009. They could vote to have a referendum. The United States could say, we'll give everybody $1 million each in Greenland. Greenland's only got 56,000 people. We'll give you $1 million each if you become American citizens. I'd take that deal if I lived in Greenland. I mean, I guess I'd have a very different lifestyle if I lived in Greenland. But that's kind of, you know, the EU's being confronted with this geopolitical competition that they're just not equipped to handle. So I think we're going to see more of that push for a European strong leader. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I'll also mention I did write an article on Greenland that I put up on the website. There are so many really random stuff that's happened in Greenland's history that I think is kind of funny. So this was my excuse to put up in there. I think I missed out the fact that Greenland decided to set up a standing army during World War II and it had 15 people. I should have found a way to get that in there. Like, this whole region is really geopolitically significant, but at the same time often involves very small numbers of people and tiny armies and all kinds of shenanigans, like people being fired from the Coast Guard so that they can go and invade Greenland, but giving America plausible deniability. The time America accidentally exploded a nuclear bomb on Greenland. And the several attempts to buy Greenland, or even an offer to swap a bit of Alaska for Greenland. So I think Donald Trump does have a lot of... there's a lot of historical precedent for America trying to get more involved there. But he's working on creating a fortress America. Meanwhile, there are other powers very keen on piercing a fortress America or getting their own bridgehead inside fortress America. And that in some ways is the big picture behind Jeremiah's main story from Asia that sees some pretty significant moves from China into Peru.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the big story that I wanted to talk about is just that China's influence in Latin America is getting rapidly deeper. So this is it's actually a development that's been underway for some 15 years now, with China just making endless agreements with countries in Latin America to come in and build ports and railways and bridges and highways and power plants and all kinds of other infrastructure. These projects are usually under the branding of the Belt and Road Initiative. That's the Chinese Communist Party's strategy to bind nations more tightly to Beijing, just with the overall goal of making the world more dependent on China. So with each one of these projects in Latin America, the Chinese are building more and more economic power, even political power and cultural power in this region that is supposed to be part of the United States' sphere of influence. And the big story this week, as you said, is about Peru and a massive port that China just opened there. This port is in the city of Chancay, and China built a massive deep water port there for container ships, and it's designed to function really as an economic beachhead for China in Latin America. And this week they announced a new direct service shipping line from Shanghai to this port in Peru. So this is a major line, and it slashes shipping times from about 40 days down to 23 days. So it's almost down to half the time. So China's power in Latin America, it had already been increasing, but this megaport is bringing that to a whole new level. The main Chinese company that's building this port is Costco Shipping. And their institutional affairs manager said that this port has turned Peru into, quote, the gateway from South America to Asia. So it's really about more than just Peru. It has rail links bringing in Brazil's economy as well, which is the world's seventh largest economy. And also links to Colombia and Ecuador and Chile. So it's a colossal project that is just pulling more and more of the world's center of gravity toward Beijing. And the really remarkable fact is that more than 100 countries have signed on to China's Belt and Road Initiative all across Latin America and Asia and Africa and the Middle East and Europe as well. So it's a stunning number of countries, more than 100 of them. And all of this is laying the foundation for a vast trade alliance to be formed that will include much of the world. So this new Shanghai Chancay shipping line, it's really just one small part of that massive trend.
And this is, I think the way that this is playing out is really interesting, where China's moving into Latin America. The European Union, of course, they finally, after a quarter of a century of negotiations, they signed their deal with Mercosur a few weeks ago. They're very keen on creating closer relations with Latin America. So this is an important prophesied trend. Now, God, we talked about God promised America sea gates. In Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, God says, if you don't obey me, I'm going to give those sea gates to your enemies. And that's kind of what we see happening here. That's what we have already seen with the Panama Canal and China moving in there, and Donald Trump has recognized that. That's related to this trend where we're seeing China and Europe moving into an area that is very close to the United States, and China setting up important sea bases and infrastructure. It's important to note, and you often do, Jeremiah, that these companies like Costco and they're not like Microsoft and Google, where there's one guy in charge and he's kind of got his own agenda that's separate from the US government agenda. And usually that agenda is to make money. These are countries that by law have very, or companies that by law have very strong links to the Chinese Communist Party. So when they're setting up these bases, there's more to this than just making money. There's a strategic aspect to this. So you've got that prophecy as well. And yeah, there's an opportunity if the nation repents, and that's not just about leaders, that's about individuals, there's an opportunity for God to come in and protect America. And Mr. Flaherty, you made that clear in that Key of David and in that clip that we played there. But if that repentance doesn't happen, well, this trend of other countries getting control of these sea gates and then ultimately freezing America out of world trade, that is just going to continue. And the Bible is very clear about that. And that's something we've written about quite a bit before as well.
That's right. Yes. Specifically, there are prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27. And they talk about this economic alliance that's called a Mart of Nations that will form between China and Russia and European powers as well. And when you put those chapters alongside what you just mentioned there, Deuteronomy 28:52, it's easy to see that the main reason why this economic alliance is formed is to besiege the United States and to block it out of world trade. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Terrell Fleury has written quite a lot about this over the years, especially in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. And he has drawn special attention to Latin America's role in all of this. He emphasizes how the European nations already have considerable influence over many Latin American nations. That's partly because they have the shared languages, they have the shared religion as well. And Mr. Fleury says that once China and Russia form this Mart of Nations with Europe, then all the power that China and Russia are now building and establishing in Latin America will translate into even greater European control over that region. So this story about the port in Peru, it is just a small part of that very large picture and a globe-girdling trend. And it's all about this anti-American alliance. And it points to some potentially very dark times on the horizon.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Before we move on, I think you did have another couple of shorter stories to update us of significance from Asia as well.
That's right. First, a quick story about Indonesia. This is the world's fourth most populous country, just behind India, China, and the U.S. They've got about 267 million people. They also have a GDP of about $1 trillion. So it is a very significant nation. And on Monday, it became a full member of the BRICS organization. BRICS, of course, is headed by Russia and China. And it's widely seen as an anti-American group working against the United States and especially against the US dollar. And it was actually just last week that Indonesia gained entrance into the organization as an observer. And now here we are just a few days later and they've become a full member. So this is more evidence that BRICS is growing. It's growing larger and more relevant. And even though BRICS at present has very little real cohesion, it could grow much more unified and formidable in the years ahead. And since it is an anti-American organization, that could have some very grave implications for the United States. And then the last story I wanted to talk about is about Russia. Russia is a BRICS member, as I said, and perhaps the most anti-American of them all under President Putin. And this week, an investigation was published by Insider and Der Spiegel showing that Putin's agents set up a scheme back when the U.S. military was in Afghanistan to pay Taliban forces and other terrorists in Afghanistan to kill U.S. soldiers and allies of the U.S. soldiers as well. So this is extremely disturbing. And there were questions about the veracity of this report when it first came out a few years ago, because at that time it was based on unnamed sources and anonymous authorities. But Insider and Der Spiegel have been digging into this for years, and they found a whole collection of emails that were sent between Russia's military intelligence service and these terrorists in Afghanistan. They've also found paper trails showing these terrorists visiting Moscow to collect payment and the receipts as well from payments through Russian banks. And the evidence has been corroborated also by testimony from Douglas London, the former CIA chief for counterterrorism in South and Southwest Asia. And it all shows that these Taliban terrorists and other Afghan terrorists would get $200,000 for each U.S. soldier they killed. So it's remarkably evil, even by the standards of Putin's Russia, but it was effective. It killed many U.S. servicemen. And this is just more evidence showing that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury was right when he wrote, Putin is not just an authoritarian leader. He is a vengeful, monstrous friend of the devil with all sorts of anti-God policies. He's steeped in secrecy, deception, manipulation, aggression, intimidation, coercion, and force. And there's far more about him that we do not know. So that's what Mr. Fleury wrote in 2017. And as you just heard there, he said, there's a lot about Putin's evil that we don't even know. But now, thanks to this study that was just published this week, we do know a little bit more about Putin and his satanic methods.
And I think it shows more about why America does need to think about who's got the Panama Canal, who's got Greenland. Like, that we live in a world where there are evil leaders and there are nations trying to take the United States down. And you do have Russia paying Taliban fighters to attack the US. It's a world that does require constant vigilance, and just kind of handing over the Panama Canal to Panama and letting them just sell it off, or sell off it, or let China gain big stakes and heavy influence in it, that's a recipe for disaster. So I think it even underscores that point. I just wanted to bring one piece of breaking news that's just happened while we've been on air just over the last 10 minutes or so, where President Donald Trump has received his sentence. So this is where he was found guilty of 34 counts of, I think it was some kind of financial fraud. This is the Stormy Daniel case, where he paid money for this pornography actress to keep quiet about her allegations, whether or not they're true or not. You know, he paid her to keep quiet. That happens. He uniquely was prosecuted for fraud and for not reporting these payments in the right way. And the judge just handed down the sentence, and the sentence is nothing. There is no real punishment there. So it is a unconditional discharge. So no jail time, no fines, no prohibitions. It's all done. There's no punishment there. So, and that's just a miraculous turnaround. It's more evidence of God miraculously protecting Donald Trump. And I think you look at his background, and there are some unsavory things that he has done, but he has some courage, and I think it's more about what God is doing than the man that he is using. And so there's another opportunity for him to begin his presidency with a clean slate, another opportunity really then for God to reach America and have America repent and turn away from all of these sins. Well, I did want to talk about Germany as well, and Germany and Austria. I mentioned that kind of political earthquake right at the very beginning, where Austria's chancellor resigned, and this is something that's caused a lot of consternation within Germany. So I covered this briefly last week, where Austria's attempts to form a coalition after their September election fell apart. We saw that before the show aired on Friday, where this Freedom Party of Austria, this party founded by a couple of ex-SS members, they won the election, and three other mainstream parties, they were all going to kind of come together and form a coalition, a very unwieldy coalition of parties that disagreed with each other, to block the Freedom Party of Austria out, the FPO. They've been talking for weeks, they've been talking for months. It all fell apart last week. They didn't manage it. And so that officially fell apart. Then after we aired the show, this was over the weekend, the Austrian Chancellor announced his resignation, that he would resign both as Chancellor and as party leader, opening the way for the Freedom Party of Austria then to negotiate with his party, the People's Party, kind of Austria's equivalent of the Republicans, the right-wing party. And so now it looks like you're going to have this Freedom Party of Austria, this FPO, this party founded by the far right, founded by these ex-SS officers, that they will supply the chancellor, that they will be the main party, and that the what used to be the mainstream right-wing party, the main right-wing party, will be just the junior coalition partner holding them up. And like I said, that caused a big shock in Germany because they're having exactly the same dynamics. And there is talk of, well, could you see something similar happening in Germany? And then, as Andrew alluded to, Elon Musk has really been raising the profile of the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, this fringe right party within Germany. So Alice Wiedel, I guess it would be. So she talked to Elon Musk last night on Twitter on an X stream. And I think she did a fantastic job of making her party sound rational, normal, not extreme. And this is the message that Elon Musk has been pushing about the Alternative for Deutschland, that they're being unfairly maligned as far right. And listening to that, you know, I didn't really find very much at all in their discussion that I disagreed with. It was a very rational analysis of the major problems affecting Germany. I mean, we can play a clip. I think we can play one of the ones about windmills or environmental energy to give you a flavor of what they were talking about here.
If you were to replace one nuclear power plant, let's say like Emsland nuclear power plant here in Germany, with an annual electricity production of 10 billion kilowatt per hour, with modern wind turbines, with a production of just 8 million kilowatt per hour per year, you would need 1,250 wind turbines just to replace this one power plant. And with a rotor diameter of 70 meters and the minimum distance from large wind farms, you end up around with like 100 square kilometers. For example, this corresponds to half of the city, major city of Stuttgart, right? So this entire thing, and just to stress the fact again, you don't need to be very smart just to do your calculations.
She's making good points. And I think more importantly, from her point of view and the message she's working to get across, that does not at all, you know, she does not at all come across as far right or anything close. I mean, she's talking about Germany's decision to try and replace nuclear energy with wind farms, and how it just doesn't work. The math doesn't work out. You have to have an entire city of windmills to replace one relatively small nuclear power station. And so they were talking along these lines. And the only thing that really generated controversy in the German press was that she said, well, the Nazis, they're nationalist socialists, they were left wing. I mean, I kind of agree with her on that too. I think all the people hyperventilating about that in the German press are wrong. I mean, we've made the same point. Andrew's made the same point on this show, that you look at Nazi economic policy and it's about state ownership of the means of production. Like, it's left wing. I mean, in some ways, this whole left wing, right wing model that you get from the aftermath of the French Revolution is outdated. Or the two sides kind of, it's almost a circle, and far left and far right start to get quite hard to distinguish. So there wasn't really much in there to disagree with. And I think this is the danger of what Elon Musk is doing, is he is allowing the Alternative for Deutschland to really put themselves forwards in this very credible way. And in this way that it is, like, if I knew nothing else about that party, then yeah, absolutely, I would be nodding along and saying, they sound great, they sound rational, they're talking about Germany's real problems. I mean, she talked about the migrant crisis that came up, but it was all very, very reasonable. I have said more extreme things on this show than she said in that interview with Elon Musk. Like, it was all pretty vanilla. So I think that this is giving a false impression, though, through all of these. And I think the one area where I kind of disagreed and I thought that it was false, I think points to the area of danger with the Alternative for Deutschland. So they had a discussion there where they were talking about, she was talking about, Wiedel, that you don't want a yes man. Like, if you're a boss, you don't want your employees to just blindly agree with you. And so he's saying, well, she was then saying, well, America doesn't want Germany to be a yes man. You want your allies to stand up and agree with you or disagree with you. And Elon Musk was saying, yeah, you know, that's right. When we're launching rockets into space, if somebody thinks the rocket's going to blow up, I want him to tell me, because you can't cheat the laws of physics. He's exactly right on that. But I think the analogy break, that's not a good analogy. Like, international politics is not, the way that it's played out today, is not a situation that has a single right and wrong answer. Like, you look at what's happening in Ukraine, and it's not a case of like, actually, there's one right answer right out there. And if everybody comes up with that right answer, Russia's going to be happy, Ukraine's going to be happy, America's going to be happy, and the war ends. Like, I mean, in some ways, there is simplicity in the Bible and in God's government and the return of Jesus Christ. But in this framework of the world, it doesn't work that way. And so nations can have clashing interests, nations can have wars. And I think when they talk about it as this analogy of, well, Germany has America's best interests at heart, and sometimes Germany having America's best interests at heart will mean speaking up and saying, actually, we think you're going in the wrong direction, this isn't a good idea. Like, that analogy is fundamentally flawed. And I think she gave a perhaps more revealing portrait of herself and her beliefs in an article that also caused quite a stir within Germany, that she wrote for the American Conservative, where she said that the US is a strange empire, an empire that rules the world from Monday to Wednesday, but doesn't want to do so again from Thursday to Sunday. I think there's some truth to that. She does have a good way of turning a phrase sometimes. But then she said, well, Germany, she wrote in there, was America's slave. And she said, slaves don't fight. Therefore, she wrote, when President Donald Trump demands that Germany must take responsibility for its own security in the future, he should also be clear about the full consequences, that we will listen kindly to his concerns about Nord Stream and our energy supply, but that we will make our own decisions and he must accept them whether he likes it or not. I mean, she is right. She is saying, if Germany militarizes, if we build a decent military, if we're not dependent on the United States for our defense, we're going to do what we want and we're not going to listen to you. That will be the natural consequence of Germany doing that. And yeah, that is true. That is the case. And that is not good for America. Like, that isn't just friendly disagreements as we all try and launch a rocket to Mars. This is, well, what if Germany decides what it wants to do is means harming America? Like, that they define their interests in opposition to America. They decide we need to take America down a bit so that we can be stronger. Like, that's what it means for Germany to stand on its own two feet, and much more than taking America down a bit. And, you know, I made this point, I was subbing in or guest hosting on the Trumpet Daily Show a few weeks back and made this point that you look at what the Alternative for Deutschland are saying in German, and it's that, but much, much more extreme. I mentioned this magazine called Compact. They sent an email out about the Beatle interview before it happened to you, encouraging you to watch it on their YouTube channel, that they would provide live translation into German. And this is this magazine that's for AfD supporters. And they've had articles about Eisenhower's death camps, alleging that General Eisenhower locked German soldiers in concentration camps. They called Winston Churchill genocidal. They talked about how honorable German soldiers are in World War II. So you allow this kind of interview that Alice Weidel had, and they can sound very rational. You get them off that, and you especially look at World War II, and you see they have a very radically different view of the world. And ultimately, they see America as a force for evil. And in some ways, they're right in that America spreads a huge amount of pornography and degenerate music. Like, there is a lot of filth going out of the United States. And in that way, they are a force for evil. They see them as a geopolitical force for evil, that they need to break America's power in order for Germany to be great. That is the worldview of the Alternative for Deutschland. And that's a dangerous worldview for a lot more than just America. So that's what we're seeing with Elon Musk kind of normalizing this group. And really, the rise of the alternative for Deutschland is something that is very concerning. This is what Mr. Flurry had to say about this rise in a Key of David earlier this year.
They have a new party in Germany called the Alternative für Deutschland. They take second place in national polls. Second place in Germany. And it's really a Nazi party. That's something to think about. Something we all ought to be concerned about. Just think about this. There is a danger in every fifth German voting for the far right. Every fifth German is voting for the far right, talking about Nazism. This is the fastest growing party in Germany. What do you think is happening there? Something that we've been prophesying for over 75 years.
One of my colleagues here just pointed out that we do not, in fact, have a time machine. That was not the Key of David from May 2025, but May 2024, a recent one from last year. But it is a sign of something rising in Germany that we've been warning about for years. But the big thing to watch in Germany, and the big thing that's going to make a difference here, and the big thing that really I think a lot of these AfD supporters want, is a strong man. And that's something Mr. Flurry also really pointed to into that same Key of David. We can play that next clip now.
But here again, you see, we're looking at a big problem. That AfD party that I just mentioned, the Nazi party, they don't have a charismatic leader. They don't have a real leader. And that's why everybody in Europe, it seems like, is wanting, at least those that are close to Germany, want a Charlemagne, and they want him soon. They know they have to have one if they're going to stand up to Russia and China and Iran and their allies.
They know that they need a strong leader. And yeah, that's, I think that is something. Alice Riddle, she suits the AfD for now. She's good at appearing mainstream when being interviewed with Elon Musk. She's not that strong leader. And probably the AfD cannot provide that strong leader, because then they would look too extreme and off-putting. And so, yeah, there's a lot of dissatisfaction in Germany for very good reason. And they're going to look much more for their strong leader. That's what to really watch out for coming out of this election that is coming up in February. Watch for all of this dissatisfaction in Germany to lead for a strong leader. Watch for them to look for their own strong leader that can stand up to Donald Trump. And we have our booklet on that too. A strong German leader is imminent. That takes you through exactly why the Bible prophesied that. I mean, Mr. Flurry, you saw that. He talked about, we've been saying this for years and years and years. That booklet will take you through that and show you how we have been saying that for years and years and years. I mean, one quick story I wanted to also mention that ties right in with this is Emmanuel Macron was speaking on Monday, where he talked about Europe needing to form a new military coalition separate from NATO that would include countries like France, Germany, Italy, Poland, and the Baltic states. I think this is a really interesting story, as you see Europe increasingly see themselves in competition with the United States. So they're saying, well, we don't like NATO. The US is in NATO. It's also interesting that he didn't say, well, we need the European Union to step up. He called for a different kind of smaller, tighter block. And that is exactly what the Bible says. It says that God is going to rise up in Europe to punish the United States, a smaller, tighter union, a union of 10 nations. And you could see exactly the kind of thing that Emmanuel Macron is talking about, leading straight to that. So I think that is another important story to keep an eye on. Well, Middle East, also another important area of the world to keep an eye on. And we've also had some kind of dramatic political news there coming from Lebanon.
Yes. Yesterday, after 2 years of gridlock, the Lebanese parliament has finally elected a new president, General Joseph Aoun, who was the head of the Lebanese army. That was not a slur of mine there. Lebanon actually has not had a sitting head of state in about 2 years. The president in Lebanon is mostly symbolic, but he has some important powers, like actually forming the government and the prime minister and the people that actually make the decisions. And so for this whole time, Lebanon's actually been governed by a caretaker regime after the last president, Michel Aoun, no relation. His term expired and they couldn't agree on who to put in. This is part of the reason why you've seen so much problems there over the last few years with Hezbollah becoming the dominant mover and shaker in the country, acting outside of even the official state institutions, and why when Israel invaded Lebanon and went after Hezbollah, the actual government and the army itself more or less stayed out of it, because at that point they weren't actually really the main power player in Lebanon. But looks like this is all coming to a close, and that's not a coincidence that it comes on the heels of Hezbollah being decapitated and neutralized by Israel to a great degree. Lebanon's politics is a bit, well, it's a reflection of the people that live there, and like the reflection of the people that live there, it is quite complicated. Lebanon is, of course, a hodgepodge of different religions, ethnicities, etc. And when they got independence from France decades ago, they agreed on that certain groups would have certain positions of power within the country. The president would be a Maronite Christian, which is like an autonomous church that's connected to the Catholic Church. The prime minister would be, which would be the main decision maker in the government, would be a Sunni Muslim. The speaker of the house would be a Shiite Muslim, and the deputy prime minister would be an Orthodox Christian. Obviously, the president is the office that oversees the whole thing, and it is a pretty I guess you could say tantalizing prize to the Catholics, but that doesn't mean they all necessarily are pro-West or whatnot. Michel Aoun, for his part, has had connections to Hezbollah. And in this last election, Hezbollah tried to boycott the election. They tried to force in through their own candidate, but eventually it failed, and there was a bit of outside pressure from other countries to get that in. Aoun, the general that's coming in, for his part, he's seen as a pro-U.S. candidate. The army, the Lebanese army, is like the one institution in the country that has general levels of respect between all the different sects and religions. And while we don't know exactly how things are going to go with this new president, Lebanon, of course, has a whole host of problems that probably aren't going away anytime soon. But in his first address to Parliament, Aoun called for the Lebanese state to get full control over the army, for the state army to be the only organization to have exclusive right to bear arms, which essentially means he's agreeing with the Israeli ceasefire with Hezbollah. And when he said that, the parliament erupted in standing ovation to him, the longest in there, with the notable exception of Hezbollah's MPs just sitting there staying silent.
And what about, is it Amal or there's that other military, Shiite military group?
Oh, the Amal movement. Yeah, they started off being a competitor to Hezbollah. Now they sort of, there's really nobody else that stands for their causes, so I don't really know exactly how they participated, but Hezbollah, for their part, obviously, they're not just a militia, they're also a political party, and they have a sizable influence in the parliament, and they're, and of course, they've been the ones that's been stonewalling, causing all these political deadlock for the longest time, and so their absence was noticeable.
So that's kind of them not being there, it's a sign that their power has already been broken. And it's going to lead to more setbacks for Hezbollah, probably.
Totally. And with the vote for parliament, it actually was observed by different representatives from outside nations, including the United States, Saudi Arabia, and France. And Aoun, for his part, one person, when they were voting for the president, voted for Joseph Amos bin Farhan, which is basically mixing up the new president's name with Amos Hochstein, the U.S. representative, and the Saudi representative there too. So he is very much seen as like a Western American Gulf States preferred candidate.
My favorite, actually, vote there came from when somebody voted for Bernie Sanders. I'm not usually that enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders receiving a vote for anything, but that somebody in the Lebanese parliament would be feeling the burn enough to vote. I love, this is from Jerusalem Post. They wrote that Sanders won another term in the Senate, meaning the US Senate, not the Lebanese Senate, but they won another term in the Senate last November, but for multiple reasons is ineligible to lead Lebanon. So not sure why somebody in Lebanon is such a Sanders supporter. More significantly, though, we've been watching for Lebanon to move into the European orbit. This is something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry predicted very specifically. This is something that we have focused a lot on as we've watched Israel go into Lebanon and dismantle Hezbollah, that this is going to lead Lebanon into the European orbit. And this seems right in line with that trend.
Exactly. And the reason we follow that trend is a prophecy in Psalm 83 specifically. Well, verses 1 to 5 set the scene about this alliance coming together, going after the people of Israel. And if you study the prophecy in its entirety, you see that there's no alliance other of the people that form it or of that particular purpose that have ever come to pass, which is why Mr. Flerius pointed that to being a prophecy. Verses 6 through 8 talk about which countries will be involved in it, lists a bunch of ancient names for that have modern descendants today. Specifically, the most important part of that would be at the very bottom, Asher or the Assyrians, Germany, but also mentioned are Gebal and Tyre, which are two Phoenician city-states that are still cities in Lebanon today, and tying that in with other related prophecies like Daniel 11, which we have plenty of material to explain that prophecy too, but it's a bit outside the scope of this segment, shows that Germany will be clashing with a radical Islamist camp led by Iran, which implies that the countries allied with Germany are not going to be allied with Iran. To this point, Lebanon, through Hezbollah, has been arguably the Iranian's biggest lapdog in its proxy empire. And because of that, we've expected Hezbollah, at the very least, to lose power in Lebanon, if not be outright kicked out. And when the Israelis came in and started killing Hassan Nasrallah and doing all these other things, we wrote an article in our November-December printish edition of last year called Hezbollah's Days Are Numbered, which talked about some of the different things the Israelis are doing and where this could lead. Specifically, we speculated that if Israel is going to be decapitating Hezbollah, does that leave a power vacuum that the indigenous enemies of Hezbollah can exploit? And maybe it's not necessarily a violent exploitation at this point, but it is still happening in the sense of, again, Hezbollah's power is being broken in Beirut. They're putting in somebody to lead the country that's not allied with them, that is a more pro-Western candidate. I can almost guarantee you we have not seen the last of unrest in Lebanon or some of the other political maneuverings happening there, but this is certainly a step in that direction that we're watching for.
All right, well, thank you very much for that. Do you want to just quickly give us the final stories that you have from the Middle East as we just wrap this up today?
Sure. Well, actually ties in with one you mentioned, Emmanuel Macron on Monday. He also talked about Europe's relations with Iran, and he said that Iran's nuclear program was reaching, quote, the point of no return, and even publicly spoke about the E3, France, Britain, or Germany putting back some of those snapback sanctions of the JCPOA. Talk at this point, but it's the most serious talk we've heard about it from somebody that can still do that, that's still part of the JCPOA that we've seen. And also yesterday, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to sanction the International Criminal Court over its arrest warrants of Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant in Israel. That has to go through the Senate, but now that the Republicans have a majority in the Senate, it's expected to pass, and that basically means a seizure of property for anybody that has anything to do with it. They're banned from entering the U.S. of anybody involved in sanctioning U.S. targets or targets of ally or people affiliated with allied nations that are not party to the treaty that established the court. Whether that will have anything to do with, I mean, I don't think the ICC has much to do in the States anyway, so they may choose to ignore it, but it also puts a lot of pressure on countries that say they will accept the court's verdict in arresting Netanyahu, and they could potentially fall under some of these sanctions as well, once they get passed.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. I think we've touched on all kinds of stories, almost an overwhelming number of stories from all around the world. I will just try and focus on two follow-up materials in this conclusion here to kind of wrap it all up. Why natural disasters, that will take you through why you have earthquakes and fires and all of that. Again, it's a very short little booklet. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com, and we'd be happy to send that to you anywhere in the world, or you can read it online there as well. And then the Key of David, from last week on the Panama Canal and how that was prophesied, the important way that that ties in with Bible prophecy. I think that really is a central piece for our whole discussion on North America and Greenland and on all of these different things that we touched on. And that's just a 25-minute video that you can get, again, on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll link to it in the show notes. You can find it on YouTube and I think Rumble as well. If you have any difficulty in finding those, please do just drop us an email, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenge for engineering and production. We will be back with our Wednesday show on Wednesday, surprisingly enough. And until then, keep watching your world.